The Reds were winning the game that we were watching at the time, and I looked up at my mom and said, I'm going to root for the Reds. And she said, you can't do that. The Red Sox are your team. And even though, I mean, at that point, I'm tiny, but I could still smell the aura of doom. I know I'm in Seattle, so I'm preaching to the choir here. The Red Sox are your team. It is wrong to bail out on them because they're losing. You stay with your team no matter what. Besides, one of these days they're going to win this thing. And you will feel pretty stupid if you bailed out on them before that happened. So I've been a Red Sox fan ever since. I remember Bucky Dent the way some people remember Sirhan Sirhan. I was watching the World Series in a basement in Newton in 1986 when that ball skipped nimbly through Bill Buckner's legs. And my friend Andrew, who was with me at the time, the basement ceiling was about this tall, about this high, was so outraged that he stood up and punched the ceiling so hard that he dented the linoleum in the kitchen upstairs. I just sat there with the plaster dust in my hair, numb, with the sinking feeling in my gut. And later that night, we were walking back from the store when we were accosted by this just abysmally inebriated Red Sox fan whose universe had once again been destroyed. He made us do push-ups on the greasy blacktop of a gas station to offer up some sort of atonement to a universe that had reached out once again to crush him. He was huge, we were small, and as I pushed up and down off of that oil-soaked pavement, I thought that somehow it all made sense. In George W. Bush's America, being even moderately liberal is like being a Red Sox fan. You know what needs to happen, you know what's right, and some cosmic force akin to the shade of Babe Ruth always manages to come down and crush you right at the moment when you're about to achieve something good and great, like, for example, the 2000 election. If you do manage to get your lineup together, home run issues, grand slam arguments, all-star players, which we have a few of right now, you will get completely outspent by the damn Yankees, who are sitting in your division with more money than God and the will to use it. Politics, like baseball, has no spending limits. And then, of course, there are the umpires. I remember with painful specificity a game in the 1999 American League Championship Series between the Red Sox and the Yankees. Red Sox players running like hell for second base, and Chuck Knobloch swings a tag at him that missed by this much. The umpire called him out. And no amount of dirt kicking and screaming and yelling could reverse that call. The Red Sox wound up losing the series, and the Yankees went on to win their 2,000,000th World Series. Knobloch sucks. He hit Keith Olbermann's mother with a baseball. This ESPN announcer, one of those wild throws that he threw from second to first, went up into the audience and beamed main ESPN announcer's mother right in the head. It was poetry. In George W. Bush's America, the umpires sit in front of television cameras and work for major news networks. They look and speak like fashion models instead of journalists. They draw their paychecks from General Electric, Viacom, Disney, AOL Time Warner, and Rupert Murdoch. There is no appealing the calls that they make, day after day, night after night, even when there is a barnload of visible daylight between their interpretation of what happened and what actually happened. They hide behind their masks, and all the screaming and dirt kicking doesn't change a thing. Baseball is, of course, only a game. There is an annual celebration of shock, heartbreak, rage, and woe in Boston at the conclusion of every season. The lights go off at Fenway, the bags are packed, and the bats are put in storage. Red Sox Nation shrugs its shoulders and turns its collective focus to Foxborough, where another local team has recently learned to overcome the generational curse of assured failure. There is always some other team to turn to when Nomar and Manny and Pedro disembark for Point South until April. Life goes on. No one is dead. No one is broken. No one is sick. No true damage is done. This is not the case in George W. Bush's America. The season never ends here, and the dead bodies are piling up in grisly snowdrifts. They finally came out with an estimate of the number of Iraqi soldiers that were killed in this thing. 45,000. The lies are constant, and the ranks of the broken and abused are swelling inexorably towards some awful critical mass. That war in Iraq, treated like a sporting event with bullets instead of baseballs, has cost us over 300 troops at this point, I believe. Several thousand troops who have lost arms and legs and testicles and faces, who will never be the same. Thousands and thousands and thousands of civilians who are coming more, more are coming every day, shot down by nervous 19-year-olds who have no business being in the situation that they've been put in. The 3rd Infantry Division is not a police force. It's not nation building. A friend of mine who was in the military said once something that I will always remember, that the Army is good for two things, killing people and breaking stuff. Anything beyond that is above their pay grade. These kids have been left out to dry. What does any of this have to do with baseball? This is serious stuff. As serious as anything this nation has faced in its history. And one of the things that you deal with, or I've been dealing with, I'm sure you've been dealing with, is just this almost unbelievable sense of self-interest from people who are talking about this war. Don't care what goes on in Iraq. It's not my problem. It's 15,000 miles away, right? Well, here's what you can tell them. And this is the best part. This is probably my favorite part. They lied about the Iraq-Al-Qaeda connections with their bare faces hanging out and started a war that shredded Iraq to such a degree and brought such chaos that now it is becoming a hotbed for Al-Qaeda activity. They created that which they were lying about. So when you are dealing with people whose own self-interest says, Iraq is not my problem, you can tell them what red alert means. Red alert is martial law, the suspension of habeas corpus, the suspension of posse comitatus. That's what's going to happen if something else blows up over here. The governor of New Jersey was asked several months ago what red alert means to the average citizen. And he said, quote, it means that you stay in your house. It means that if you go out on the street, you are considered an enemy combatant. Habeas corpus is the fundamental underpinning of our rule of law in this country. That was, by the way, originally redacted by John Ashcroft in the first draft of the Patriot Act. Robert Byrd put it back. Posse comitatus is the law that says that the cops are civilians and not soldiers. Very different rules of engagement. This war has been the greatest recruiting poster for Al-Qaeda ever. And we are facing a situation where we have put ourselves in much more danger. So if you want to get in people's faces and into their own self-interest and explain to them why this is important to them, you can explain to them what red alert means. Back to baseball. What does this have to do with it? With all of this happening and with no easy way to reverse or blunt this course, wouldn't it be easier to just give up? Where do I get off making trite sports analogies in this situation? I do it because it's instructive when considering the next step. The issue here is a simple matter of hope. People of good conscience cannot surrender the struggle against the rising tide with all that is at stake. At the end of the day, the point is simple. Even if it is a losing fight, which I don't believe it is, it wouldn't be any kind of a fight at all if we didn't show up to fight it. You have to capture the mentality. You have to capture the mentality of the Red Sox fan, as I have. You start every season almost completely sure that you will be beaten soundly. You lick your wounds and dust yourself off and maybe cry a little bit into your pillow. But you always, always think to yourself, even after the Bucky Dents and the Bill Buckners and the Yankees outspending you and the umpires not doing their jobs, you always think, this could be it. This could be the year. You do it because you want to be there at the turning of the tide. The Boston Red Sox have not won a championship in 85 years, and there is no sign that they are coming close this year or anytime soon. Yet the stands in Fenway Park are filled night after night to capacity. The crowd cheers and hoots and prays and comes back again and again. In its own small way, this is the very definition of hope. When that day dawns, when some October night, in a time to come, absorbs the victory roar of people who have watched great-grandfathers and grandfathers and fathers live their entire lives and die unfulfilled, when the Red Sox finally do win the World Series, it will have been worth every minute of pain and suffering. One of my favorite sports memories is when the New York Rangers won the Stanley Cup after like 40 years. There was this incredibly old guy up in the nosebleed seats after they were bringing the cup out who stood up with a banner that said, "Now I can die in peace." That's just baseball. This is America. At bottom, America is an idea. You can have all of our roads, our crops, our people, our cities, our armies. You can take all of that away. And the idea, however unfulfilled it has been, will still be there, as pure and great as anything conceived by the human mind. I am one of these fools who thinks that the idea that is America is one of the last best hopes for humankind. When used properly, it can work wonders. The idea itself is in mortal peril. You can keep all the roads, all the cities, all the crops, all the people, all the armies, you can keep all of that. But if you murder the idea, you have murdered America itself in a way that 10,000 September 11s could never do. And the men and women within this current administration are murdering the idea that is America with their lies, with their patriot acts, with their making you afraid, with their destruction of civil liberties, their daily undermining of even the most basic tenets of decency and freedom and justice that we have tried to live up to for the last 227 years. One of the worst things that has ever happened in this country was when these people became able in public to use words like freedom, justice, democracy, patriotism, for those good and noble words became the foulest of lies when passing their lips. That, and that alone, should be enough to get you on your feet with your fist in the air or out in the street come tomorrow and Saturday, whether or not you believe we have a chance of success. We may not win, but we have to fight them. If we don't, we are the traitors that some would say we are. When all else fails, I fall back on the words of the extraordinary anti-war activist Daniel Berrigan. A friend of Berrigan's, a man named Mitchell Snyder, was for years an advocate and activist for the homeless in Washington, D.C. Snyder became despondent over the fact that his government could spend billions on bombs and guns, but couldn't seem to find the money to help the homeless. He became so despondent that he committed suicide. Daniel Berrigan penned these lines in memory of Snyder. And it is in these lines that I find my own courage and hope when the darkness creeps too close. Some stood up once and sat down. Some walked a mile and walked away. Some stood up twice and sat down. "I've had it," they said. Some walked 2 miles, then walked away. "It's too much," they cried. Some stood and stood and stood. They were taken for fools. They were taken for being taken in. Some walked and walked and walked. They walked the earth, they walked the waters, they walked the air. "Why do you stand?" they were asked. "And why do you walk?" "Because of the children," they said. "And because of the heart, and because of the bread. Because the cause is the heart's beat, and the children born, and the risen bread. The cause is the heart's beat. This cause is my heart's beat. It's yours. May it be there for all time, until the day comes when we can once again stand in awe and pride before our flag and our government and our nation, when we can revel in that rescued dream that is America. Until then, we are at the barricades and on the streets and in the faces of all of those who would spend our precious blood on lies and profit and greed. They can take nothing from us that we are not willing to give. and we are not willing to give this great nation up. Let them be warned. We stand our ground. Thank you. I'm going to perhaps predictably start with the microphone on the left.
So will you comment on who you'll be showing up for in the presidential race, like Dennis Kucinich?
Everyone. One of the problems that I have as the managing editor of Truthout, Truthout is a nonprofit organization, which means by law we can't advocate for anybody in particular. As managing editor, I can't. Right now, I'll say I will vote for any one of them. With a great big smile on my face. I have my preferences, of course. I have my top three horses. I've met Mr. Kucinich on three different occasions since I've been on the road. And he is, if you've ever had the chance, or if you can find the chance, to go see Dennis Kucinich speak, it's awesome. I saw him out in San Diego, and he came out very quietly. And, you know, it was a packed room, 1,000 people going nuts to see him. And he just stood there at the podium very quietly, very silently until everybody shut up. And then he went, "Oh, say does that star-spangled banner yet wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave." And then started pounding on the podium, screaming, "Courage, America! Courage, America!" And made the direct connection in that verse of our own anthem between courage and freedom. The land of the free, home of the brave. He's great. I also like Howard Dean. I also like John Kerry. I will vote for any of them to get these fiends out of the White House. I don't care. There may be some people in this room who say if X candidate or Y candidate doesn't win the nomination, I'm going to not vote. And I have a number of good reasons, very quickly, to disabuse you of that notion. Dick Cheney, Don Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Perle, John Poindexter, Lewis Libby, John Bolton, Condoleezza Rice, John Ashcroft, Colin Powell, etc., etc., etc. House cleaning. You know, I was talking to Ed about this earlier. We're talking about the various merits of different candidates. Let's say, for example, that John Kerry wins the election, or Howard Dean wins the election. Certainly, neither of these men are as progressive as we would like them to be. And, you know, John Kerry's got two rather large albatrosses around his neck, the Iraq War here and the Patriot Act here. My thought upon welcoming either of these two guys into the White House, or any one of them, is that right now we're in a situation where George has his base, and they're nuts. Like, they're the scary people, right? He's listening to them because he has to, because he needs them. My thinking is that if one of these people does happen to win, we sit back, pop a bottle of champagne, or in my case, we'll, you know, knock a scotch, smile, take a nap, and get right back to work. This doesn't end after the election. This is just beginning. There is a groundswell of progressive energy in this country that has scarcely begun to be tapped. And if one of these guys gets into the White House, we will run right up their back and stand on their head. And that's the deal.
During the first Gulf War, I don't know any of the numbers, and I'd like to have you speak about the numbers of Gulf War syndrome victims and how that's going to play out in this war in terms of numbers, because it's a much longer period of time that these people are being exposed to this radiation and a lot more numbers of people.
I'm not 100% sure the numbers of the effects upon the Iraqi people. I know that something like 1.5 million of them have died from a variety of things, from the sanctions to the war, to probably the fact that because of all the depleted uranium, Baghdad is one of the hottest places on Earth. I do know that the Vietnam War caused a disability rate among our soldiers of 9%. The Gulf War caused a disability rate of our soldiers of 26%. That is the depleted uranium. That is the vaccines that they were shot with. That is the oil smoke and a variety of other factors. 26%.
And they were only there for a week or so.
They were there for a day, yeah, if you believe what you hear. I don't think that there are already some creepy cases popping up, some weird pneumonias and other such things, which is the great part about being in George Bush's America if you're a soldier. They just cut $12 billion from veterans benefits, and when you get back from the war, it takes 6 months to see a vet doctor. 6 months! There's an article popping up on Truth Out tomorrow called Depleted Uranium, What Support the Troops Really Means. I suggest that you seek it out and read it because it's footnoted to the heavens about what's going on with this particular situation. So, yes?
One of the biggest disconnects for me in this war has been the delay between the start of the war and the search for Saddam Hussein. And why did it take 3 months to start looking? I'd like to hear about your thoughts or data about why it was 3 months late, and perhaps some speculation about whose Swiss villa he may be living in.
Well, he's Goldberg. Raise your hand if you get the reference. 1984, The Enemy, The 2 Minutes Hate, right up there with Osama. He does a lot more good for these boys free than he does captured. I don't know why they waited so long to go after him. Probably because, like Osama bin Laden, he went from being wanted dead or alive to not much of a priority. They could give a damn about where he is. They went in to lock down the petroleum and to begin to set up their permanent military presence there so they could start eyeballing the other countries in that region. Unfortunately, they've been caught. And now they're going to have a little bit of trouble gearing up for another war, because even the mainstream media at this point is going to have a lot of trouble buying what they're going to try to sell. I'll tell you something. If we are going to get ready to go to war on Iran, you'll know it, because there'll be all this footage on television from 1979 of Americans in hoods. All right? That's pulling on the heartstrings. I don't know where he could be next. He could be here, for all I know. He could be in Paris with Osama, Amelia Earhart, and Jim Morrison, living in sin. And Elvis, of course, and Elvis. Well, he is Elvis. I think less important than finding him, again, is, to a certain extent, that is a little bit secondary. It's something that we can beat the administration over the head with, yet another thing. You know, how is it possible that this terrible criminal got away along with Osama? And then, by the way, why did you lie about the war? So, yes.
Yeah, well, I think it bears mentioning that a lot of the precursor to the ease of which Bush and company have enabled this run-up to the war and the subsequent launching of this taxpayer-subsidized land grab in the Middle East is the role that they play in the manipulation of state politics. And I think it bears mentioning that every 10 years we have what's called a census. And immediately after census, there's a process called redistricting. Mm-hmm. And in the state of Texas right now, we have 11 Democratic legislators with the state of Texas that are holed up in a hotel room in Albuquerque, New Mexico, refusing to attend quorum call because if they go back to Texas at this point, they face house arrest. And what they're trying to do is prevent a two-thirds majority in the Texas legislature that will allow the state of Texas to redistrict several areas in that state, ostensibly jamming minorities into a select few districts in order to spread the Republican wealth for vote getting. Yep. In the state. I'd like your thoughts on that. And a second part to this is the amount of money that the Bush administration spent in the state of Minnesota leading up to the 2002 Senate elections in the state of Minnesota, the millions of dollars that they poured into the campaign of the opponent of Senator Paul Wellstone. And I'd like to know what your thoughts are on would Bush have had it this easy had someone like Wellstone still been alive to contest it?
That last part I can answer definitely. Well, not definitely, but I got some pretty good information on that one. These boys play for keeps as far as the redistricting stuff goes. I think it is as evident as anything else that has happened, the fact that we are not dealing with people who have any respect whatsoever for the process. They think that they are well aware that they're a minority party and so have to do these things in order to maintain the hold that they have, which begs the question, what are we prepared to do to counteract that? That's something to ponder. Another story that's going to be up on Truth Out tomorrow is that the Texas 11 have sued the Texas State GOP for the stuff that has been dumped on them. So this is now a much more interesting process. The money that they dumped into, they wanted to beat Wellstone so bad. He was their main juicy target. What kind of effect that he would have on the process at this point depends upon how other elections shook out, whether or not they would have, the Democrats would have been able to maintain their majority status in the Senate. I mean, Henry Waxman has been the single most important person in the House of Representatives chasing down these Halliburton connections. You should check Waxman's House of Representatives webpage on a daily basis, because every day he's written another letter to Condoleezza Rice or to Don Rumsfeld, none of which will be answered, but that breaks down in viciously minute detail exactly what the hell is going on here. And you're never hearing about it because they don't have majority control, they don't have subpoena power, and they cannot set the agenda. I would suffer another 4 years of George W. Bush in the White House if I could get the House back. Amen. If you are looking for something to do, find a Republican House member somewhere and figure out a way to help beat him. That is equally important. George's whole prospect completely changes when we can get Henry Waxman taking on the mantle of Dan Burton. That would be fun to watch. As for Mr. Wellstone, I was privileged recently to give the keynote address at the Veterans for Peace Convention in San Francisco. And Mr. Wellstone was a favorite son of those guys. And the subject of his death came up, the questionable subject. And it's worth questioning. One of the things that I talked about with United Defense was that the concept of pulse power, you know what that is? When you light off a nuclear bomb, it causes an electromagnetic pulse that essentially turns off and annihilates any solid-state electronic technology. A pulse power weapon focuses that on a particular place. Basically, what pulse power weapons do is turn airplanes off in midair. But several of the pilots who were associated with Vets for Peace, several of the people who were closely associated with Wellstone and with his campaign, basically indicated that the pilot on that particular plane was an absolute buckethead. Hadn't slept the night before, had a lot of issues, had very little flying time, and these guys who are as close to Wellstone as his own skin are firmly convinced that it was what it seemed to be, just an idiot who didn't know how to fly. So that's that.
I'm addressing the question both to the speaker and also the audience. For calendar year 2003, will you be paying United States taxes?
Yes, for a variety of reasons. I will be paying my state taxes because it still goes to the schools that I used to teach in. I'm not going to do anybody any good if I'm in jail, which is entirely possible. But I do think that if you choose to not pay your taxes as a means of protest, there are organizations out there that can help you do so and can get you legal representation, can tell you what you need to do in order to be able to do that. There are Quakers all throughout this country who haven't been paying taxes for 20 years, and they're still walking around alive and free. So it is possible. But I don't know. I am going to pay my taxes.
I recall a quote from a United States leader to the effect that those who finance terrorists are terrorists.
Do you have a car? Do you have a car?
Yes.
Okay, you put gas in it?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm a visitor.
Welcome to the club.
I'm a visitor.
It is almost impossible in this country to avoid participating in that which we would oppose for our whole lives. And the book that they're selling over here is the meat of an essay that I wrote about a year and a half ago called Boycott Everything. And the sum and substance of it is that We can do a lot of different things as activists, but as an individual, one of the best things that you can do is stop feeding your money to the beast that would eat you. If there are ways that you can vote with your wallet, do so, because that, at the end of the day, is where it really hurts these guys. It's exactly what you're talking about. Yes?
Yeah, I was just wondering, how come the administration hasn't actually tried to plant weapons of mass destruction? I mean, ever since Baghdad fell, I was half expecting them to find a boatload, and of course they'd just, you know, be conveniently planted by the CIA or something like
right.
that.
Problem with Iraqi chemical weapons, biological weapons, the stuff that they were brewing for a very long time before we destroyed it, is the fact that it has a unique chemical signature that can only be duplicated by creating chemical weapons in an Iraqi lab using Iraqi substances and the processes that they use to develop it. It leaves a fingerprint that is impossible to duplicate unless you go out into Utah and build yourself an Iraqi chemical weapons lab and process the stuff there. Wouldn't put it past them, but that's a lot of work. The international community was nose deep in Iraq for years and years and years. Most of the experts on Iraqi weapons of mass destruction are from outside the United States and beyond the parameters of the Bush administration. If they're going to be accepted as having found this stuff, they're going to have to sell whatever they find to these outside inspectors. The stuff will get vetted. It will have to be tested to prove that it is what they say it is. And at the moment, I don't think that they're quite desperate enough to take that dare. Some of these guys are actually pretty smart. Some of these guys are – that's one of my favorite things about – a lot of people think that this people in the administration are these, like, evil geniuses, right? Like, they're – boom, 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 they're so smart. There's a book over on the table there by Al Franken that became a bestseller before it was ever printed because the geniuses at Fox helped it be so. These guys aren't smart. They just have a lot of money. But to answer your question, that is probably why this stuff hasn't gotten planted over there, because if they're going to have any kind of credibility whatsoever, they're going to have to pass this stuff through the eye of the international community. I mean, in America, they could say, we found it, look, but can't see it. And the American media would say, woohoo, they found it, bah. Do you remember a few months ago? I mean, it's only like 25% of the people already think we found this stuff. Thank you, talk radio. Because they make these big announcements, we found it, and then they never go back and say they didn't. George W. Bush said himself, we found the weapons. Direct quote. Remember when they found that gas centrifuge under the rose bush? That one was my personal favorite, because I had to actually, I don't know if you know anything about gas centrifuges. I had to go look it up. They're very delicate, and if you get dust in them, they're useless. This thing sat under a bush for 12 years. It's evidence of a very robust nuclear program from the first Bush administration. So they've got, it's not just as easy as dumping the stuff in the desert and saying, I found it. Although they could stick a vial in somebody in some troop's pocket and send them out and bring them back and say, look, we found it. At this point, no matter what they find, cannot possibly match up to the rhetoric that they've vomited out day after day after day after day after day. So, yes.
I'd just like to know if there is some sort of a connection between Israel and the United States, and since Wormser and Feith and Wolfowitz and Pearl had
yep.
something to do with
yep.
Netanyahu's.
This is one of the biggest problems within
right
the progressive
on.
Community, and it is something that we are going to have to get our hands around sooner rather than later. This issue of the Project for the New American Century and the motives behind these individuals who have pushed this war sits smack in the center of the biggest rift in the progressive community. You get to talking about Israel and Palestine, someone is going to come up and kick your ass because you can't talk about it. You either are on one side or you are on the other. And the problem that we have right now is that you cannot talk about the motives of the Project for the New American Century without talking about Israel and the fact that these guys harebrainedly think that they are defending Israel
exactly.
by starting war after war after war after war in the Middle East. Bus in Jerusalem a couple of days ago seems to indicate that the plan is not really panning out. But if we can't talk about it, That means we can't talk about why they lied. We can't talk about the administration itself. This is the kind of situation that is perfect for the people who pull this stuff off. I mean, the single most common scene in the entire progressive community is two people who agree on 98% of the issues screaming furiously at each other. That has to stop. Because if we cannot deal with that issue, we're going to get bulldozed. Because these people are well-funded and disciplined in a way that open-minded people who actually appreciate a diversity of opinions are not. All right? It's our biggest strength, and it is our Achilles heel. And if we cannot address this issue surrounding Israel, it's not even Israel. I always hesitate to say it's Israel. Yeah, it's Likud.
It's the religious right.
It is the Likudian party in Israel that has somehow or another ingratiated itself into the fundamental underpinnings of neoconservative thinking.
Yeah, and that have inflicted the suffering for the moderates who think wisely.
Exactly. Biggest disaster. The problem between Israel and Palestine is a failure of leadership. Between Sharon, between Arafat, thank you, and between Mr. Bush. You know, it's a trifecta of terrible stuff. When Rabin got shot was about the worst thing that has ever happened in this entire situation. You know, I remember when all the hardliners came out, and there's maybe 5,000 of them. The media was like, damn, there's quite a lot of these people. This means something. And then the next day, Rabin came out, and something like 150,000 people showed up and danced and partied and talked about, oh, this is so great. You know, we're finally getting somewhere. He comes off stage, goes to his car, and gets shot in the back. And it has been downhill ever since. So thank you for bringing that up. Yes?
I was interested in your perspective as an educator and a teacher regarding No Child Left Behind and high-stakes testing and what it might do towards the privatization of schools in America.
No Child Left Behind, no military recruiter left behind. You guys are all aware of that this one of the central linchpins of the No Child Left Behind thing was the ability of military recruiters to get lists of schools, you know, school children. That's important. That's moral. As a teacher, my perspective on what's been going on with the education process in America, it's all part of what has been commonly come to be defined as the dumbing down of America. We produce stupid children because we enjoy the circular argument. We totally underfund our education, our public school educational systems, and then certain demagogues say, look, the public school systems are not working. Let's underfund the school systems. And it goes around and around and around. It's been going on for a while. Pretty much since it really picked up speed in the Reagan administration and developed kind of a life of its own. You know, these pat lines tend to do that, like Al Gore invented the internet. That thing has a life of its own. It's not true, but, they never refuted it, which kind of makes me crazy. But beyond that, in Massachusetts, we have something called the MCAS. I don't know if you're aware of what that is. It's essentially like the SATs. You have to take it. It's a standardized test. I'm sure you guys have it. Everybody has it because it's the quick fix. You take the MCAS or you don't graduate. So the teachers wind up teaching to the test and not teaching about whatever it is they might want to teach about and letting the free flow of ideas happen in a classroom, which from my perspective, I purposefully taught in a private school because I wasn't having anything to do with that. The problem is, and this is the real important part, is that by doing this, we steal from our children the ability to teach them about why they should care about the process, why they should care about the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, our own history, what actually happened in this country. They learn how to take a test, and they walk out dumber than they did when they walked in. Speaking of Dennis Kucinich, I don't know who it was that brought Dennis Kucinich up. One of his platforms is to take, I think it's something like 15% of the Pentagon's budget and dump it into social programs like education, Social Security, and all the rest of that. Not a bad idea. It's the same kind of fix that needs to happen, for my money, with the media. We need to find someone who is willing to re-regulate the media. And we have more allies than we think we do. Mr. Powell in the FCC has been getting the poop beaten out of him lately, which is nice. And he's now backtracking and making up these kind of, well, we'll do a fake study to try to figure out how badly we're actually screwing things up. Re-regulating the media will solve, you know, a good deal of these problems. And what that will do more than anything else is reintroduce to the American people real news, real information, the stuff that they need to know. There's two phrases in journalism, spinach and pudding. Spinach is the leafy stuff that doesn't taste good and, you know, but you have to eat it because it's got all the nutritional value. Pudding is tasty and light and yummy and has no nutritional value whatsoever. Spinach is the Office of Special Plans, the missing weapons of mass destruction, Halliburton's connections to Mr. Cheney, what happened on September 11th, why is the war in Afghanistan still going on, etc., etc., etc. Pudding, thank you, pudding is Kobe Bryant. Which do you see more of? I was out in Montana the other day, and yesterday, as a matter of fact, and I asked the crowd to raise their hand. How many people in the crowd own guns? And it was Montana, so a bunch of hands went up. And I said, okay, everyone whose hand is not up, find these people after we're done, borrow their gun, go home, and shoot your television. Don't. I have a friend of mine named Matt. Great activist, this guy. Worked from home for years and used to always sit there on his computer with CNN in the background. He got a job about 3 months ago in an office where he has to leave the house every day and go to work and come back, you know, 9 to 5, 9 to 6, whatever. He is a new person. I mean, literally, he is so much happier and at peace and motivated than he was when he sat in front of the soul-sucking machine that lied to him moment to moment every day for 12 hours. Turn it off. If we can re-regulate the media, we will re-educate the American people into what is actually important. If we can refund public education, you know, I love those old bumper stickers about it would be, it's a great day when the bake sale bumper stickers. I think of, who's that guy down for the Texas Rangers who got $250 million contract?
Alex Rodriguez.
Alex A-Rod. It would be wonderful if someday A-Rod had to get paid 10% above the poverty rate while teachers got bid for the highest services. That would be nice.
You've spoken of America, the American dream, the American vision in very positive, flowing terms. I wish to question that. Is what we are experiencing...
Somebody always does. So.
What we are experiencing now really an aberration? Is it really different from what we've been doing for generation after generation after generation? When we ask who is the problem, is it really them, or is it possibly us? And the problem is, at least a majority of us, the problem is that we're really not willing, we want to be nice people, and we're really not willing to face up to what we have to do to other people to maintain the empire. But in fact, we are aware that if the empire goes, the American way of life, the American way of consumption goes with it. And that, how many of us are really willing to accept that?
Well, hopefully we're working to find out. You're absolutely right. I was talking earlier today about reading Howard Zinn, reading Noam Chomsky. You know, one of the most important days of my life was when I actually sat down and read A People's History of the United States. I was depressed for about a year after that. And I had to come to exactly what we were talking about today, come to a certain understanding with myself. I wasn't around when slavery happened. I wasn't around when World War II happened. I was a twinkle in my mother's eye for Vietnam. I was young and dumb for the Gulf War. And I know good and well that the ideas that I'm talking about have never been lived up to. But this thing is happening on my watch. And there are 100 different ways, personally, for me to approach how to reach people and make them understand just how messed up all of this is. And though we have never lived up to the idea itself has merit. and should be raised, because it is still reachable. And you're right. If we were to stop doing what we were doing, our quote-unquote standard of living would be substantively different. In other words, we'd have to probably live the way 40, 50, 60% of the country and most of the rest of the world lives. And perhaps right now, the American people aren't willing to do that. They don't know any better. Garbage in, garbage out. But I talk about the idea as a way to bring people towards a higher understanding of what our responsibilities are. It's the difference between what America is and what America should be. And I go to bed all right every night raising that idea, because I'm going to spend the rest of my life trying to figure out a way to move us incrementally closer to that. And the fact that we've never lived up to it in the past, and the fact that we may never live up to it in the future, the idea itself deserves the effort.
Just lower that a little bit. Two plugs. First off, Dennis Kucinich is on The Daily Show tonight on Comedy Central at 11.
What am I doing here?
And the second plug is that 11 o'clock, the Declaration of Independence road tour is at Mohai right now, so go check it out. And the question is that, seeing as how Bush has obviously committed crimes against the country and crimes against the American people, factor in the fact that the Republicans have control of the House, the Senate, and the Supreme Court, practically. Is there a possibility for impeachment, and if so, how?
It was the Republicans that got Nixon.
Okay.
I think that one of the most important things that we need to recognize as activists is that Republicans are not the enemy. Conservatives are not the enemy. These guys in Washington are not Republicans and not conservatives. They are something else. They are something different and far, far, far more dangerous. The definition of fascism, as defined by Benito Mussolini, who invented it in a barn in the 20s, fascism is the combination of state and corporate power. It is not the Nazis. It is not the gas chambers, although that was certainly part of one interpretation of it. We have this really kind of happy, narcissistic, benign fascism going on right now, so invisible to so many people that they don't even quite know what it is that they're looking at when they look at it. But I think, from my own perspective and from traveling around to Arizona and Montana and Colorado, these hotbeds of Republicanism, I always get people coming up to me being like, I just listened to your talk. I'm a Republican. I can't believe this is going on. A bunch of the guys in Veterans for Peace are super conservatives, but they are not buying what these guys are selling. And the problems that Mr. Powell and the FCC are enduring right now is happening for simply one reason, and one reason only, because conservatives and liberals have gotten together to kick some ass. I guess, well, I can squeak one in really quickly and then got to get rolling here.
You've touched on a lot of things tonight. Thank you for coming. And
thank you for having me.
Standing here, I had three things come to mind. Have you heard the story of...
Microphone.
Oh, have you heard the story that was out just this last weekend that there was a military officer or something in Iraq, an American military officer, that swears that he saw Saddam Hussein put on a U.S. Air Force plane and jet it out of the country?
I had read that. I don't know if Al Martin was the source. So
I don't think it was Al Martin.
I read it. It was intriguing. I'm waiting for a little bit more confirmation.
Okay.
Because that's. They flew the Bin Ladens out of Boston, and I know that because it was front page on the Boston Globe, and you can go look it up in the archives if you want to spend the money to find the article.
He had three questions, but
Cool.
I was just hoping that you might speak to us a little about what your views are right now on the California recall.
Yeah. I was fortunate enough to be out in San Diego and San Francisco when this thing was really starting to pop. Well, the interesting thing about it is that it's legal. It's in the Constitution. part of the liberal reforms that were brought several decades ago account for the ability to have a recall. I believe that Daryl Issa, the rep from the 49th District down in California, paid $1.6 million of his own money to get the signatures, which amounts to basically a dollar a signature. I think that it is a dangerous trend. I think that anytime anybody has a bankroll enough to motivate disaffected voters to throw an elected governor out is a dangerous precedent throughout the entire country. I'm enjoying watching Arnold squirm. He's getting his butt kicked from all sides. I think the prospects for coming out of this relatively unscathed, with the exception of the precedent that's being set, are not bad, because the conservatives are eating themselves. And that bodes well. So we'll see what happens. I love the idea that Enron is being blamed on Gray Davis. That if you need an example of how far in space the mainstream corporate media is, there's your example right there.
Just one more. Two. I will be fast. In addition to the demonstrations of activism we're all going to do tomorrow and Saturday, Howard Dean will be in town at Westlake at 6 o'clock.
Cool.
Sunday night, 6 o'clock. Quick question. I was very disturbed when I heard President Clinton suggest regarding the 16-word sentence that we should just go on and forget it because every president makes a mistake. What do you think his motivation was?
I flipped out when I heard that. I was like, Bill, shut up! Shut up, Bill! But then I thought about it again. And I said, here is Bill on television, Bill, of the cigar and the stained dress, saying, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, presidents make mistakes. Here is Bill Clinton in the mainstream media world, the most undefendable human since Hitler, aligning himself with Mr. Bush. That is an indelible image for a number of people. And I have to think, I mean, you can say what you want about Bill Clinton, there's plenty to say. He was the sharpest political operator we have seen in our lives. And I had to sit down long and hard and, you know, chew my own teeth off for a minute before I came to the conclusion that I think probably he did that on purpose. And I think that was what he was trying to do, jumping on the hand grenade, as it were, serving a purpose.
Wouldn't have anything to do
with
08.
With what? You mean Hillary?
Yeah.
Who knows? Possibly. I think that they're not thinking that far ahead right now.
What purpose?
Hillary running for president. She said 08. Hillary running for president. Jumping on the hand grenade I don't know how the two of those would connect. The hand grenade is bringing up the fact that presidents make mistakes. He's standing there and rehashing history and doing it sitting right next to George, basically. I don't know. It might have just been him being an idiot. I mean, there's no question that Mr. Bill's judgment can periodically be called into question. But I also think that connection was made. So, yeah.
Sir, this is a rather solemn point that I'm going to bring up and that we're ending on. But we live in a time where we have the potentiality of unending war for the rest of our lives if we let this current administration have their way. You know, we've seen unspeakable things happen on our television from the war. And there's also... there's never been a period in the history of our country where we've had more teen suicides ever. I live on Bainbridge Island. We've had three in the last year and a half. There's 20,000 people that live on that island. There's maybe more that I don't know about. But I guess the question is there a connection? And if there is a connection, it seems to me this would be an issue that we could have bipartisan support around, because it seems to me the children are something we can all agree on.
Not leaving them behind, right? The way that you would bring bipartisan connection on that one would be to get conservatives and Republicans to agree that something is in fact wrong, okay? And that is in large part what it is that we have to deal with. I think there's no question that, I mean, for my money in this whole thing, we can talk about the details of this stuff all day long. You know, there's all sorts of things that we could talk about. I've written 3 books in a year merely because there's so much to talk about. But at the end of the day, I think the single most important thing that we have to focus on for the children and for everybody else is the need in this country for all of us and for everyone else that is out there to overcome being afraid. That's it. That's everything. That's all of it. These guys are getting away with this stuff by terrifying the American people. That's how they do this. And if we can overcome our own fear to speak out, to get on the street, if we can convince other people to do that, and it was part of what he was talking about when he introduced me, do something that buys you the right to look at yourself when you come home. If you wear a Bush socks button out on the street and 50 people see you do that, who would feel the same way that you do but are too afraid to make that kind of a statement, however small, themselves, you have worked wonders. Your courage emboldens other people, and emboldening other people is part of the game here. It's one of the things that I'm going to talk about on Saturday at the rally, is to stop being afraid. And the last, just one thing occurred to me thinking about the gentleman's question before, because it's the ultimate question for me, is that it was 40 years ago that Martin Luther, just right 40 years ago very recently, that Martin Luther King gave his I Have a Dream speech. He was speaking about ideals that I'm speaking about, and America was the same kind of country it was then that it is now. Those are still good words. And there's still good ideals to live up to. And to a certain extent, I don't care how disaffected, disillusioned, and disgusted you are with this country, how it has always been and how it may always be. The point of the exercise is to spend your life trying to change that. And that's it. That's the best that you can do. So thank you very much for having me here.
You've been listening to William Rivers Pitt speaking last week in Seattle. Several events of interest are coming up here in the Finger Lakes for people wanting to become more active and informed on the issues discussed in today's program. Ithaca's 3rd annual Progressive Festival will be held next Saturday, September 6th, from 4 to 10 p.m. at the Center Pavilion on the Ithaca Commons. Many organizations will have informational tables, including Ithaca Community Radio 88.1. Some of the presentations will include music. There will also be poetry, political speeches, and games. That's this coming Saturday, September 6th, from 4 to 10 p.m. on the Commons in Ithaca. Ithaca Community Radio will be sponsoring a debate for the Democratic primary candidates running for mayor of the city of Ithaca. The debate will take place on Tuesday, September 2nd, at the Unitarian Universalist Church on the corner of Aurora Street and Buffalo Street, from 7 p.m. to 8:30 p.m., and will be broadcast live on WEOS and Ithaca Community Radio. Admission is free and open to the public. For more information on the debate, contact Jeff Kirby at area code 607-273-3209. And if you'd like to contact us or download MP3s of prior programs of Unwelcome Guests, you can contact us at our website at unwelcomeguests.org. Thanks to the LA Sound Posse and the Seattle Independent Media Center for their contribution to today's program. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Yeah.